Welcome to this special edition of the Active Photographer Podcast, your behind-the-scenes glimpse into the day-to-day life of a working professional photographer, with me, Giles Babbage. I've put together these Focus Extra shows in addition to the regular weekly podcasts in order to bring you all the conversations I recorded live at Focus on Imaging 2013. There's a lot to get through, so each recording will lead straight into the next. In this third and final edition, I'm talking with ISO monitors and Paramo waterproof clothing. As ever, you can check out all the show notes to this and all other shows at theactivephotographer.com. As ever, you can check out all the show notes to this and all other shows at theactivephotographer.com. Once again, I'm on the ISO stand, and this year I'm talking to a gentleman sat next to me called Victor Aberdeen, who, according to his business card here, is External Accounts Manager for Creative Design and Media. That's quite a title, Victor.
No, I don't go by titles. How boring that is, isn't it?
But at the end of the day, Victor and I are going to talk about colour calibration and the importance to photographers, and I'm going to open our conversation with a reference for those of you who don't know who ISO are and want to know a bit more. Let's just have a quick intro to what you guys do.
Yeah, of course. ISO is a manufacturer of specialist monitors. So we do more than just the graphics ones that we've got here on the stand, but we also do medical and air traffic control monitors. So monitors used in specialist environments for people who have specific requirements. Photographers, post-production people, graphics artists, printers, all have specific requirements. And myself, you read out my lunatic title there, but let me say, I started my life as a professional photographer. Half my career has been in photography, half of it's been in technology. So I kind of now have the two mixed together. And what's important to a photographer is to be able to see what's in the file and have that reproduced out, whether it's to a printer or onto an iPad or into a book. You don't want the colours being something other than you intend them to be. And it's having that structured framework of creativity. Colour is scary to lots of people, and I understand that, because many people you speak to who are labelled with colour expert get really geeky about it, and I want to say shut up, because actually you don't need to be really geeky about it. You can be very practical and very clear through the process. So let me start at the subject, and we'll take, just for argument's sake, a fashion shoot, because somebody shooting a piece of clothing is very interested in having the colour of that clothing all the way through. But this could apply to landscape, and it could apply to, say, artistic work, maybe like Tim Flack or Perrault's work, as two examples. You can take a photo of a garment, a dress or something, but a good trick for the assistant photographers there is to stick a colour card in there, so when the photo's being taken, the master one, next to it you can put the test shot with the colour card in there, and then you have a reference and you know, was the flash firing white? Not everyone can use a bronze colour and have colour temperature dialed into the flash. So was the flash firing white? You can balance the light there of the photograph to get that right. You can work through. I'll assume everyone listening is shooting RAW. You should be.
Well, you should certainly hope so. And just on the colour chart reference, regular listeners will know, because you've heard me talking, and when I've just come out of shoots or on the train back or what have you, I have what traditional photographers, and by traditional I mean film photographers, will remember as a grey card. And I know what my grey card looks like, and it gives me a very good neutral reference in a test shot, a set of a sequence, so that when I go into my workflow, I have a reference point there. Now, one of the issues that I have, although my clients don't pick me up on colour, they're happy with how my pictures look, and I've said this before, and there are no secrets, I do have a slight problem with colour blindness in a kind of a green and a red fashion. Now, with the ISO monitors, one of the appeals for me is the fact that you guys have a built-in calibration system in some of your monitors. But just going back to what you're saying, it all boils down, surely, to confidence in being able to deliver work that you know to be accurate, that your clients are going to be happy that there is accuracy in what they're looking at?
Absolutely. And actually, your grey card's perfect, because the grey card in a photograph is a good reference point for you. And you can take that, and when you load up that picture on the monitor, you should see a grey in the accurate lighting as your grey card is. And if you put your grey card next to the monitor, you should be able to see the two the same. And importantly, the luminance of the monitor, so the brightness coming off the backlight, should be uniform so that you can see the same grey. Now, let's pick up another context there. Is minimise all the pictures and look at the background. Get rid of that picture. Make it uniform grey across the back. Many people's monitors will not be uniform grey, and they will have patches on them. They might have a colour bias. It might be a little bit blue. Load up a black and white picture and see if it looks like a black and white print. You know, hold up a book of a good black and white print next to it. I bet it's blue. Worse, it could be a bit green. Sorry, folk. That's the first element of that fundamental foundation that you need for good colour management there. So that picture coming in with that grey card, you look at it, you know it's a good grey card. The next step is the tone curve. Ooh, now people get worried. Gamma curves. Oh, boy, that sounds very mathematical. No. Just live in 2.2 as the gamma curve. Don't worry about what the number means. If you're getting into the advanced stuff, then there are other options there. And people can contact me. I'm happy to discuss that with them. Not today. But leave it on 2.2. And then with that tone curve, you'll be able to see the deeper shadows right the way through, evenly and uniformly to the top highlights. But look at the skin tones and the way they graduate away from the light, and you'll know you've got good quality tone. The next step is to add what the engineers call chroma, is the colour onto that. If you've got accurate colour on a good tone with good uniformity, you'll get a great picture. To keep it great, with a good monitor like, say, the ISO 246, we build in a calibrator, and it's a closed-loop system, so it's very accurate at keeping it accurate. And it can run 2 o'clock in the morning if you want. You can have it running every 50 hours of use on a schedule, or maybe once a week. If you run an office and have a security guard walking around, you could have it pop up when he's due to walk around, make him jump. But that device saves you the time of having to use a puck, so a spider or a X-Rite device to hang over the front of the screen. But those devices are good too, and we have screens that don't have the built-in ones that allow people to look at that. All the monitors in our colour managed colour edge range manage the colour inside the screen. So there's electronics sensors that measure the temperature affects the liquid crystals and the luminance of the backlight to make sure it's accurately represented to the user when they're looking at their pictures, so they know the colours there are what they want. Now, there's a little tipping point there in the workflow, because you get to the point where you've worked on the original files coming in, and you've got to the point where your picture is how you want it to be, and now you have to think about the output going off to print. And this is where things might flip over. If you shot in the Adobe Shooting Raw, in the Adobe colour space, your white point is 6,500. You might be going off to print in a book. You might be using Bob's Books or something similar like that. Blurb, that's the other one, isn't it? You might look at those. They might have a white point of 5,000 degrees Kelvin. So you can go and pick a different profile on your monitor, set that to 5,000. Now your white point on the monitor will suddenly look a bit yellow as opposed to the slightly blue of 6,500. But that's going to represent what the paper will look like under the good lighting conditions.
And this was always one of the things, certainly years gone by when digital was starting to become popular and people thinking, brilliant, we can save money, ironically, and print ourselves at home or in our studios, what have you. But people didn't appreciate that you need to set it up to see, know your workflow. What you see needs to be what you get and what have you. Now, a lot of the people listening to this are either keen enthusiast photographers, some are semi-pros, some are looking to make a few quid at the weekend and gradually build their way into the industry. ISO monitors are not your go-to PC world. Nothing against PC world, but go to PC world and get something. But regardless, you should always afford the best that you should to go for. And as you say, there are ways around colour management. But I think it's important, speaking to guys like yourself, it gives people food for thought, but it also gives encouragement that there are ways, and that they will probably take something away from what we're talking about. Even if it might be something about a grey card, or it might be about, you know, as you're saying, sort of just holding something alongside as a reference. So where would you say is the starting point for colour management? I mean, we're saying about the grey card and what have you, because for a lot of people, they'll go and try that, and it may not equate to working correctly.
That was really well timed into it. Well, so the starting point is the end.
Right.
So you need to start with where the pictures you want them to go. So if you're going to do pictures and you're going to put them up on the web, or you're going to show them on screen, then you need to start your colour management process thinking about where they're going to end up. If you're going to make a book out of them, then you need to, when you start working on the process of the pictures, not when you're shooting them, but when you're working on them, think about where they're going to end up. And that was the dividing line I was at. So if you're going to make a book, you know, switch that colour over, load the profile for the book up in Lightroom when you're doing the soft proofing. So on one side you can see your original picture, and the other side you can see the other. And working that way round, you're thinking about how the colour's going to render on the output device or on the web and the like. And I'd say the best piece of advice I can give anyone is to try and keep it as simple as possible.
Yeah.
So if you find a way of printing books at 6,500 Kelvin, do it.
Yeah.
Because then you're not switching about profiles, and you can keep a nice level of consistency through the process.
And that's the thing with photography is, you know, thousands of people come to focus on imaging, and they'll hear someone at a stand doing a demonstration, they'll say, this is how I do all the rest of it, and they go home and they think, right, I'm going to do it like this guy. Regular listeners will know I tend to shun what other people say. If they say this works for me, I'll say, oh, that's interesting, and I might learn something, and I might think, actually, that would work for me. However, for example, my followers will know that I don't do a lot of Photoshop work. I have nothing against Photoshop. I'm not scared of Photoshop, but I grew up shooting film, and I still have followed the whole process of wanting to get it as close to how I wanted it at the time. It doesn't mean that I don't tweak my pictures to get the best out of those raw files, but as you're saying, people have to have their own method, and technology such as yours should be there that they can, for myself, it's taking the guesswork out, it's giving the confidence, especially when you're exchanging contracts and money. That's when it starts to become paramount.
So the two things I'd like to agree with you on there. The first one is getting it right in the camera is by far the best way of getting good results throughout the process. If you're lucky enough to shoot with a Hasselblad, or even with a cheap point and shoot, I've had pictures published with cheap point and shoots, but they've been correctly exposed, they've been in focus, and when they've got in the newspaper, they've looked good because of that. I do exactly the same with a Hasselblad. I don't just assume because it's got 12 stops of dynamic range, or the new phase ones got 14 stops of dynamic. I don't assume that's going to save me. Get it right. Yeah. And then you've got that latitude to play and work with.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to encourage people, don't think because you're not a professional that you're not as good as a professional.
Yeah,
the only difference between a professional and an amateur is the professional has to do it.
Yes.
The amateur can say, I'm not going to do it today, it's not right.
Yeah.
Amateur's work can be just as exceptional and just as beautiful as a professional's.
And not having those commercial constraints.
Pressures.
Yeah, pressures. Absolutely. It's you know, people will know that I first saw a camera when I was about 8 years old, and from that point it just gradually became a more and more of a hobby, and became more and more expensive as I wanted more and more equipment and what have you, and I then turned it into a career. But you know, back at in the days when I was a member of a camera club, it was purely for the love of it that I did it. And you know, when I went to university to study photography, didn't actually learn a great deal, if I'm honest, certainly not in a technical sense, and hand on heart, I can tell you it very nearly killed my love of photography, because it was so far away from, because it was all about theory, all about how we look at pictures, and there was some psychology goes on in there and social issues. And it was just, if you can keep it, for the pure, pure love of creating images that provoke a response in yourself, in your viewers, friends, family, what have you. And when people say, do you know what, that is a lovely picture, can I have a copy on my wall? That is what you're striving for, getting that pleasure out of the images.
I skipped the university bit. Let's not go there. I did a little bit of college.
Listeners will know that I have firm beliefs about education.
Well, we can talk about that another day. But I worked under a famous photographer, a guy called John McNee. He photographed Red Rum, third win of the national. And the next day, there were 9 national dailies. His picture was on the front of 8 of them. That's a statement. Shot one frame on a Rolleiflex.
Yeah.
He used to ask me a question when I'd say, hey, look, Mac, look at this picture. What do you think? Is this great? He asked me one question. Why?
Yeah.
And if you can't answer that question, then forget it.
You need to have
a good reason why you've taken the picture, a good reason why you're presenting it to people. And it makes all the difference between a snap and a piece of art.
And you know, it has been said, certainly at this show this year, many times, photography has never been so good, because you know, you could argue till the cows come home, well, actually what we're experiencing now, the euphoria around it, was the same back in the dawn of photography, you know, the process. However, some things never change. You know, we're just very lucky that we do, for a lot of people that have never shot film, they've come into digital, they don't have to think about how many rolls of film they're going to wait trying to get the shot. They, you know, they have these tools like ISO monitors that are at their disposal. Maybe they'll have to save up for cameras and lenses and monitors and goodness knows what. But the tools are there. But that is exactly what it is, tools. And it's all about picking the tools that are right for you, that are right for your workflow and your job.
The important part of an ISO monitor is not the monitor itself, it's the fact that it puts your picture on the screen exactly as it lives in the file, exactly as it would be reproduced. It's about the photography, it's not about the technology, it's about the pictures. You know, and I'm serious, load up a black and white picture, you'll be upset to see it's not black and white. Find a place where there's an ISO monitor and have a look, and you'll see. You know, bring a memory stick if you see me at a show and say, can I have a look at these black and white pictures? Or any pictures, but, you know, and have a look. And we had a wildlife photographer here earlier loading up his pictures, and he said, they're just like the prints. And that's exactly what it's about. It's about seeing the beauty of the work. He had a fabulous picture of an otter who just caught a fish sitting on a rock, looking back, and I said, have he spotted you? And he said, yes, he looks like he's wondering if you're going to steal that fish off him. And it's like, it was exquisite, the photography, and that's what I love. And we've got rolling, sitting behind you here, a 4K screen rolling through the Wildlife Photographer of the Year photographs. We sponsor that competition, and the prize winners last year all went home, the top winners all went home with a 27-inch ISO, and they were delighted with it, and the photography's fabulous.
Well, of course, there are a lot of listeners. The Active Photographer is listened to, the podcast, and the site is viewed all over the world, as you'd imagine. In the top 10, the US is nearly always top of the list, you know, so we have a big following over there. For those that obviously haven't been at Focus on Imaging, they listen to the show. For those that can't get to their, you know, local, you know, place to see ISO in action, as it were, where should they go? Give us a web link or something like that.
Well, you can go to ISO.com, and if you look at the graphics monitors there, there's some good information. But let's skip the product a little bit at the moment. But go down to the bottom of the web page, and there's a thing called the ISO library. Go into the ISO library, there's a section on color management. It's not geeky, and there's a fabulous set of PDFs there about the history of color.
Very interesting PDFs.
And I think they're fabulous for people to read about, because it gives you an idea that actually color is not just about what you see, it's about a philosophy. And if anyone saw the Horizon show, I think it was Horizon last year, where they had some Africans who have no word for blue or green, they have one word that describes both colors, and when asked to spot the odd one out of a cyan circle in a ring of green ones, They couldn't. There wasn't one.
Wow.
So colour is far more philosophical than just, as art is, than just the technical part of the colour. You know, we can measure it to where blue in the face.
And I think there'll be a lot of people, and if you fall into this bracket, please send me a message or get in touch on Twitter or what have you. Let me know what you thought of this conversation, because I'm sure a lot of you at the top of our chat here were thinking, right, they're going to talk about colour spaces and monitors and calibration, what have you. And actually, it's clear, speaking to you, Victor, that you have a passion not just for product and calibration, but it goes deeper than that, as it does with all of us, that it's all about the final result, and whether you start at the end to get to the beginning and what have you, that is the important thing. So I think a lot of people are going to be pleasantly surprised with what they've heard today. I will, of course, be linking to ISO in the show notes, as you would expect. But for now, Victor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And I know you guys have had a very good show. It's coming towards the end of the show now on the final day as we record this. So I think everyone's going to look forward to a cup of tea, and I'll look forward to seeing you again in the near future.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. As ever, one of my returning visits year on year is to the Paramo stand, and a lot of you will know that I speak with Catherine and Helen, the ladies of Paramo, as I like to think. But there we go, that's another matter. We have a new product in front of us, Helen.
We do, yes, it's the Halcon Traveller. It's new for the show, so it's an exclusive look at it. The Halcon Traveller is a summer jacket. It's an evolution from our Halcon waistcoat, which was launched last year. A jacket designed with load carrying in mind, so huge numbers of pockets, perfect for secreting all those items that a photographer out in the field will want, need, designed for load carrying in mind. So the jacket is designed so that rather than all the weight hanging on the neck, it's actually spread across the shoulders, designed so that you can actually carry a fair amount of kit with you, potentially without actually having to put a rucksack on instead.
And I think that's, it's one of those things. It is a kind of an obvious thing, the idea of carrying kit and how you do it. But of course, there's a whole wealth of bags on the market. There's various photographers' jackets, and the trouble with photographers' jackets is that they look like photographers' jackets. And I'm not going to name brands, but there are certain ones that I've tried that they look as though they could stop a bullet, because they look so kind of industrial and Catherine's now joined us. So we've got this jacket here, and of course the previous incarnation, as it were, was a sleeveless version. So we've got 12 pockets, I believe.
That's right, 12 pockets, and actually a couple of little compartments as well on top of that, where you can put your glasses or a pen or whatever to hold them in place so you can easily find them. But as Giles just said, the thing that's different about all our stuff, I would say, is it's much softer. Mm. You know, the fabric's really set Paramo apart. And just as our waterproofs are softer and quieter, the Cotton Plus fabric that this uses, which is a cotton mix with synthetics, it's not just tough, but it's quiet, it's soft, it's easy to wear. You can wear it all day, like one of our waterproofs. You don't feel that you're actually encased in anything.
No.
You feel it's quite gentle on the skin and gentle to
and that's
wear.
It I know in your printed material, in front of us here, we've got your Hill and Mountain and the Summer and Travel leaflets, which are widely available. If you guys haven't been to the Covent Garden store, the flagship store, and you are in and around London, you should definitely check it out, because you can check out the whole range, and it's well worth looking, and pick up some of these little booklets here. But within those, you do refer to the whole kind of the crisp packet feel of jackets, and some people might think it's a funny thing to say, but it is a kind of one of those terms that is bandied around, because so many outdoor jackets and trousers sound so they just make so much noise, sort of rustling. And I know you guys have a lot of following with wildlife photographers, bird spotters, people that maybe walk through woodland and they're likely to see deer and that thing. And we've spoken in the past about ethics and ethical production, and I know you guys do great work with, in other countries to support building projects and water projects and what have you. But Helen, when it comes to actually choosing the materials, where do you start? Because obviously you have to year on year be thinking about how to push the ranges forward.
Yes, exactly.
One of the things that when we just touched base the other day, yesterday actually,
one of the things I kind of mentioned about this jacket is that, yes, it is a kind of a green finish, but it doesn't look like a wildlife photographer's jacket. You could wear it in an urban environment, and it doesn't look out of place. But where do you start with picking the right material, the right look for the market?
Well, the Halcon Traveller really evolved from the Halcon Waistcoat, insofar as the Halcon Waistcoat was very much a photographers but also wildlife watchers waistcoat, with lots of pockets in mind, and really kind of focusing for that market. The Halcon Traveller, in contrast, is actually a far broader audience potentially, because you could use it as a travel jacket. You've got your passport in there and a few other bits and pieces, and it's a summer jacket. It's designed for climates where you don't actually want very much insulation, but you maybe want a jacket that's going to be more versatile as a result. And so I think the Halcon Traveller, as the name suggests, it's a broader audience, isn't solely designed for someone that is interested in wildlife photography. I think it looks good in an urban setting as well. So an urban action photographer, it could be a whole range of activities that it then gets used for and it is fitting for.
And Catherine, this is something that I picked up on. I tried one of these on yesterday, and regular listeners will know that I'm a great fan of your Velez Adventure smock.
Yeah.
And your clothes have slightly smaller fits, some of them are slightly wider, but this is more of a fitted design.
Yeah.
Because it's not, like as Helen just said, it's designed for somewhere, for travel, being comfortable. So you're not going to be wearing fleeces and this, that and the other. Tell us a little bit about the fitting, because one of the things that you showed me right down there, sort of the hem, was it's expandable.
Yeah, there's a number of features on it that make it... I mean, there are two things it needs, really. It needs to be fitted, not just for the look, but to actually be able to carry the weight, because otherwise the weight you're carrying will just swing around and get in your way, and you'll be lopsided and it'll be pulling around your neck. So it's kind of engineered across the shoulder to do that. And it also has a waist draw cord, so you can pull it in to fit. And as you pointed out, there's some poppers on the back, you can just hear them there, so that you can actually open the back flap, so to speak. Sounds a bit dodgy. So it means you're although you've got it well fitted, it isn't actually unpleasant to wear. It's not restrictive. You can actually climb up hills in it, you can sit down easily in it, so it gives you that whole range of movement, and yet without compromising the carrying ability.
And when you look at in terms of the physical appearance, a lot of people will be aware of what ripstop looks like on tents and so forth. So it's a very, very subtle pattern of that effect. Can we have a look inside, because I know since we've got sort of mesh sort of panelling and so forth. It all helps for wicking away the moisture to keep you comfortable.
Yeah,
more pockets on the inside, more zipped pockets.
Yeah. Two pockets at the top and two pockets at the bottom that are just kind of drop pockets with an elasticated top, so things don't fall out. Mm. But yeah, you've got a number of different things. You've got your standard fabric, but you've got a nice fleecy lined collar, so again, it's comfort around the neck. And then you've got these mesh pockets, so that you've got a pocket, but it doesn't mean you've got extra heat building up there, because you've got too much fabric, so the mesh lets it breathe.
That's what I find is often I'll have a phone in an inside pocket, and if there is no escape for that moisture,
it just builds
up, and you have to wipe off your phone. It can't be good for the phones.
No.
You have to wipe the phones off. Now, one thing that a lot of people might be thinking is, okay, if the weather does turn whilst you're out and about, how is this jacket set up? Helen, maybe you can tell us, do we have a hood here? Do we have water repellency? What is this garment
well,
set
quite
up?
Unusually for us, this is actually a jacket, because it's designed for the summertime. Mm. It doesn't actually have a hood. However, we do recognise that sometimes you can be out, it could be a gorgeous day, but a shower suddenly comes in. So what you can do is you can treat this jacket with Nick Wax aftercare products. Tech wash as you would normally wash all of our waterproof jackets, but it's a slight change because this is a cotton blend fabric. You would use cotton proof, Nick Wax cotton proof. Then you can treat it in the washing machine with cotton proof, and it will make it water repellent. So for a shower, it will repel the water. In prolonged rain, you would actually look to wear a waterproof instead. But as a light shower, it will certainly keep you dry.
And just to clarify on this, a lot of people might wonder what tech wash is and Nick Wax. Paramo's sister company is Knitwax, and as you would expect, there are products which are designed to work perfectly for proofing and keeping the quality of the garment. I actually have put together a little video of using TX Direct to clean and wash reproof my Velez Adventure, and I will be he says I will be bringing this shortly. It's a lot of stuff's been going on the beginning of the year, but they're ready to happen. I think we've kind of covered the majority here.
Yeah.
As always, let's throw in a link there. It will be in the show notes, but if people want to find out where's the best place to either go to look at spec, to buy online, to see other photographers, other outdoors people using this kit, where are the places they should go?
Well, our main starting point would be our standard website, paramo.co.uk. But also we do have a more specific website, which is called Naturally Paramo. So if you put in that, naturallyparamo.co.uk, you'll see much more about actual photographers and using the kit and so on. And of course, join us on Facebook and so on, and we do showcase some of the photographers on there as well.
Excellent. Well, it's been a pleasure to catch up with you. It always is. I know we sort of touch base a couple of times through the year in these. A lot of people will know that I go to the outdoors shows. It's always good to kind of catch up and see what's, if nothing else, just talk about family and what's going on with people getting far too busy outside of work. So I will leave you ladies to it, because you've got people that are, you know, busting their way through the stand here to come and see all your products. So again, thank you very much, and we'll catch
up
soon.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Remember, you can check out all the show notes to this and other Focus on Imaging specials, as well as the regular weekly shows, at theactivephotographer.com. If you'd like to get in touch directly, don't forget I'm on Twitter, at Giles Babbage. There's the Facebook page, facebook.com/theactivephotographer. Or, of course, send me a good old-fashioned email, giles@theactivephotographer.com. So thanks for listening, everyone. Take care, and I'll speak to you all very soon.
Member of the CurrentPhotographer.com podcast network. Find more great photography shows at CurrentPhotographer.com/podcast.